and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Anne Curran. Anne Curran, author of two books of poetry, Placement Test and Me First, has worked as a writer at the Pittsburgh Catholic and Pittsburgh Post-Gazette newspapers, as well as editor of 20-some years at the award-winning Carnegie Mellon magazine, and as a freelance writer for the Pittsburgh Press, covering advanced features and reviews of International Poetry Forum's readings. Her poetry has appeared in numerous publications, including Rosebud Magazine, The Main Street Rag, US One Worksheets, Commonweal Magazine, Ireland of the Welcomes, and a variety of anthologies. A native Pittsburgher, she belongs to the Squirrel Hill Poetry Workshop. Her book is available at lummoxpress.com and amazon.com. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lauren.
Can you begin by reading us some poems?
I will do that. Great. This first poem is set at Sacred Heart Church in Shadyside. I went to high school right nearby, and the auxiliary bishop of Pittsburgh was living at Sacred Heart at that time, and I had done an interview with him. This happened a little later when I was a student at Duquesne University, and I had to report to him with my report card, basically. Me and my first bishop. The bishop checked my report card for the American Legion, which gave me a college scholarship because my daddy had ruined his life fighting in World War I. Now we know no one gets over that. The bishop said, "You got an A in logic, and you're a woman." He thought that was rather funny. I didn't get the joke at all. He didn't review my grades again. The Dean of Women handled that. This next poem is one of the people that I interviewed for the International Poetry Forum to do a story ahead of time before he did a reading for the forum. It's Seamus Heaney, the famous Irish Nobel Prize winner. Me and Seamus Heaney talk across the Atlantic Ocean before his Nobel. Me perched on my bed beside the only phone that hooks up to my tape recorder. He beside the waters of Dublin Bay, already bootless and knee-deep in poet talk. A cagey guy, he learned early how to hedge, growing up Catholic in Orange Territory. Even wrote about a boyhood buddy killed by the Royal Ulster Constabulary, without mentioning who did the deed. His excuse, they were off duty, two bad apples. A nicely altered cliché, he's thinking. He knew readers would blame the IRA. He teeters atop the stone wall, appeasing prods. He lives at Harvard or in Ireland, where taxi drivers chat him up about his poetry. People approach him in the local pub, not like the ivory tower U.S. poets. Frankly, he charms me for 45 minutes with stories and beliefs wrapped in a green brogue. As we close, I say, my contact wants him to do more press. His instant anger sizzles across the sea. You tell him I think I've done enough for him. That clearly included my grilling. Ouch. The distance between us suddenly expands, wider than the waters of the Atlantic. Now, this was a kind of a dream thing that happened. I had two interviews in one afternoon, two phone interviews. The first one was with Allen Ginsberg. The second one was with one of the Clancy brothers. I can't remember which one. Me and Allen Ginsberg and one of the Clancy brothers. All I remember on the downside of memory, a bright spring day, two back-to-back phone interviews. Allen Ginsberg and his best minds, beatnik buddies, dumbed, dead with dope. He, boring, bored. Someone Clancy, fresh, funny, storyteller, the brogue I love. Just no contest. And I'd like to read a poem about Nancy Marchand, most people probably remember her as from The Sopranos on HBO. She was the really mean mother. I mentioned Henry Hornbostel or Hornbostel in this poem. He was the architect of the early buildings at Carnegie Mellon and also lots of buildings around town like Rodef Shalom, the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial, the City-County Building. Me and Nancy Marchand walk across campus at what she calls Carnegie Tech. Me, a public relations drone. She, a famous actress, yet to play the monster mother of mobster Tony Soprano on HBO. Someone with an eye on her fame and purse convinced her to come home to her alma mater. Queen of the wise and imperious authority figures, she shone as Lady Sneerwell in the School for Scandal, as the nun who prompted hysterical laughter from guilt-ridden cradle Catholics in Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You, and inevitably as the wicked stepmother in Cinderella. My job, walk her to the College of Fine Arts, where she honed her skills for measured meanness and down her nose uppity dismissiveness. I tell her about the long and careful job of cleaning the exterior of this Hornbostel gem, a 3D piece of art to inspire the blooming artists. It was a building dusted with the black dirt of decades in the polluted air of the steel capital of Pittsburgh. She pulls herself up tall, stiffens, curls that lower lip, and spits out her take on the shining white edifice. I liked it better dirty. Class dismissed. We complete our walk in silence.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Anne Curran. And I'm really drawn to this sort of series that you're working with, all the this me voice juxtaposed with these famous figures, not so famous figures. How did the series come about?
Well, I just had the idea. So many times when I did interviews with people, there were things that you really couldn't put into the public, into the story that you were writing for the publication. And so I started writing poems with the extra materials that I had gathered, the observations and that sort of thing. So I had a group of poems like that, maybe 60 or so, and I approached a publisher who was interested in them. But he wanted about 30 or 35 more. And so instead of going and doing 30 or 35 more interviews, I kind of looked at the poetry I had and selected poems that I thought would work with the me and, since that's what I started out with.
Oh, that's interesting. So how is it different writing poetry than, say, journalistic writing?
You can say whatever you want. That's what I always like, too, about interviewing poets. They'll say anything. You know, they really believe in freedom of speech.
Yeah, so you feel like you have a little bit of free range to do what you like?
Pretty much.
In poems?
Of course, people can not print them, too.
Right.
Or send you nasty letters about them. You know.
So I also like this play with wit and humor in your poems. How do you weave that into sort of these overarching narratives that you're working with?
I think that's really just a point of view. That's kind of the way I look at things. And if they turn out to be funny, great. People seem to enjoy that, too. When I give readings, people react to that sort of treatment.
Right. It's also, it's like a nice break sometimes to have sort of humor in the poem as opposed to always being so dramatic, for lack of a better word, you know. It's fun to have humorous poems. So do you think the voice in those me and poems is an organic voice? It's one, a side of yourself, or do you see it as a separate character?
An organic voice, that mean it has no pesticides?
Yeah. It's closer to your own natural voice, I guess, or as opposed to using...
To some extent, I probably have different voices for different groups. But I'm not sure. Because I think we are different people with different people.
Right, exactly. So it depends on the person you're interviewing, you know, can bring out a different side of you.
Right.
And I'm sure you experience that a lot. Can you read some more poems?
Sure. This next poem comes from an experience at Carnegie Mellon, where I worked for a couple of decades. And each year they would have a day of remembrance concerning the Holocaust. And I participated somewhat. Me and Remembrance. It was a day of remembrance on campus. For 15 minutes, each would read the names of the dead, those railroaded to the death camps, Jews, Poles, Russians, the disabled, homosexuals, criminals, social democrats, communists, intelligentsia, lawyers, priests, nuns, ministers of all stripes, anyone Hitler pointed to, an 11 million death toll. I could read names. I should read names. Turns out we read birth and death dates, and my list was all little kids. Ada Halberstam, 2 months old. Itzhak Aziman, 1 year old. Emanuel Proust, 2 years old. Abraham Jacob, 3 years old. Gabor Newman, 4 years old. I could do the math easily. I could taste horror. I could not complete my 15-minute list. I failed remembrance. We all do. In a poem closer to home, I live in Chatham Village on Mount Washington, and it's like living in a park. And this is about me and a linden tree. Me and the linden. In 80 degree at 8 a.m. heat, the gnarled linden extends two sorry limbs like a pair of hands divide in despair. They speak without words. What can I do? Stuck in the mud, I try to keep you cool. Its heart-shaped leaves flutter and fall too soon. Next poem is called Me and Full Moon at Perigee. And when the moon is at perigee, that means it is at its closest point to the earth. Me and Full Moon at Perigee. I'm a sucker for moonlight, and the newspaper promised a full moon at perigee. You could have spit on it. That's how close it came, and brought 30% more moonlight than when it's farthest away. It was beautiful and bold. I couldn't see the slight dent NASA made when it attacked looking for water, not ice, and an outpost to pollute. I followed it to the street, down to the darkest parklet, where it hung, so huge between branches, slipped behind a cloud, emerged in brilliant glory, a stunning, brightened nightlight from this accidental rock, sailing through darkness and sleep, carrying the sun to us. This next poem is about an experience I had. I was sick, and I was having a lot of pain, and the doctors were, while they were trying to figure it out, was stopping the pain with various kinds of drugs, which were pretty interesting. Me and Side Effect 7. My head is booming with ideas, like birds ramming into plate glass windows, some stunned, some dead, some mumbling blue skies. I'm having conversations with you, you, and yes, you. Words are dripping from my ears, dropping from my mouth, bouncing in my bean. Who says I can't walk, chew gum, and talk, too? Love these legal drugs. Pity, no refills.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Ann Curran. And that last poem was funny.
Thank you.
I like how in that series that you just read, you're juxtaposing yourself with other things besides people, like trees and side effect number 7. So when you were constructing those poems, how did you choose which events to write about?
What I decided to write about?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the linden tree was just a really hot day, and I just was out walking and sweating and saw this tree with its limbs out like that, you know, like arms stretched out. And so I got that image and worked with it. That was it. And the moon thing was, right, another personal experience, going out and having a look at the moon when it's as close to the Earth as it will be for I don't know how many years. So that's kind of how I, just the personal experience brought the poem on.
That's interesting. So you feel inspired a lot by natural surroundings?
Sure.
I'm interested, too, in the way you end your poems. Sometimes you end with some dialogue or just an interesting image. It's always something that makes the reader feel or think something new. So how do you come to your endings?
Well, I'll tell you, as I produce it, the end is, when it works best, is a surprise to me, too.
Oh, cool.
So I get there, and just this morning I was working on something, and I thought, I know how I'm going to finish this. Well, I didn't finish it that way. It, mm-hmm. it went another way, which, you know, surprised me, too. So I figure that's the way it works. The poem has its own mind.
It does have its own mind. How do you sort of get out of the way in order to let the poem come about? Because I find that that's a challenge.
No, I don't really think about it that way. You just kind of follow it where it takes you.
Well, that's really interesting. Do you have some more poems you'd like to read?
Sure. Here's a little historical number about Columbus. Me and Columbus and the Blubberers. Let me tell you about Columbus. This is all you really need to know. One day in 1493, as he guided the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria near the future Dominican Republic, he wrote in his journal that he saw 3 mermaids. They popped right up out of the water, weren't as beautiful as they are painted, and looked more like guys than sexy gals. The Grand Mariner was at sea way too long. Biologists believe he saw manatees, great blubberers with eyes to break your heart. Now I have a couple of poems about our president. Even before he was president, I met Barack Obama at the YMCA on the Boulevard of the Allies in downtown on at the Pennsylvania primary election when he was running basically against Hillary Clinton. And I just happened to be occupying the elevator when all of these guys appeared and jammed in. Me and Barack Obama shake hands in a YMCA elevator. Me, a mild-mannered rabble-rouser with a suspicious black bag. He, a candidate for president. We exchange pleasantries. I'm still debating, Hillary or you. He opts for indirection. I always play basketball on primary day. I say, better than bowling, inserting my tennis shoe firmly in mouth. He had just lost the bowler's vote, disgracing himself at an Altoona alley. A silence fills the descending elevator, full of ball players and would-be protectors. The silence breaks. That's a low blow. They took a chance on me that day when the elevator opened, revealing a probably harmless gray-haired fan with somewhat alarming luggage. A few still stood sideways watching me. That was yesterday. Today, I'd ask more of them. Protect him from the hatred that rides high in the land of the free, home of some coward who would kill this man to intrude himself in history. at another Obama poem. I worked on both of his campaigns, and this came out of the first campaign when I was assigned to a polling place in Elliott. Me and the polling place. First, they wouldn't let me in. No signed court permission slip. No, I couldn't check the machines to start the vote off with zero. Then I said the magic words, Barack Obama. Doors opened. Want some coffee? A donut? Sure, use our phone to report the vote. Black voters poured in that morning. Moms with kids. Tons of first voters. Some dressed up, quiet, so polite, until they reached the street again with an unbridled shriek of joy. And here's one of my Irish poems. Me and my purse. My blood-red purse glows in morning sunlight. Once a real live cow, it turned grass to milk in Connemara, close to the ocean. My grandma milked it. I'm doing the same.
Thank you. So I'm interested, when you're working with sort of these historical figures or contemporary political or pop culture figures, is it difficult to work with them, writing about them? Do you feel you owe them a certain kind of respect or responsibility towards that material?
Does it show in the writing that I do that? I don't really feel like I have to back off from my own personal reaction to the person.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Hubert Humphrey, if you remember Hubert Humphrey, a long ago vice president, mm-hmm. poem where I thought that we met in the back hall of a Hilton hotel, and I went to introduce myself to him, and I felt that he was interpreting me as coming on to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any problem writing about that.
Right. No, I think as poets, we own our own experience, too, as much as the experience that we share with another person. So in that way, we're allowed to write about that. But I think some people do shy away or fear writing about, you know, famous people or historical figures, you know. They're a little nervous about it, but you seem quite comfortable.
Well, I was a little nervous, and I'm not sure how Dan Rooney would feel about the poem in my book, or I wasn't sure how the Hillmans would feel about it. I did write them a note ahead of time, sort of a heads up, here it comes.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to write what you have to write.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same sort of perplexity we have when writing about family, you know. The
right.
same thing happens. Should we be able to say this? Should we not? That kind of thing. Do you have a few more poems?
I do have some more. All right, this one has a word in it that we're not allowed to use on the radio, and when I get to that word, I'm just going to say bleep.
Fair enough.
Me and Dominic's Dictionary. Sundays before Mass, the choir practices in Mrs. Gannon's bright fifth-grade classroom. I sit at Dominic's desk and borrow his eraser, flip through his dictionary, the best dictionary for students. The front cover says, "Knowledge is power," quoting Francis Bacon in 1620. I check what's missing. Vagina, penis. There will be no action in this small book. The editors allow a female egg, but no sperm, though there's a bride and bridegroom. Don't look for bleep or fornication. Breast made the cut as two parts on the front of a woman's body that can give milk. Maybe Dom will get an upgrade next year, a sixth and seventh grader's appendix. In my seventh grade, one girl got pregnant. I doubt the dictionary did it, though. This is one of the characters I met at the YMCA. Me and the fish lady share the YMCA sauna. She drapes her clothes all over the benches. I look for a space big enough to stretch my towel and my body. She comes by bus from Carrick with two carry-ons stuffed with clothes and makes a laundromat of the Y. She needs no quarters to wash her duds. She rub-a-dub-dubs them with soap in the shower stall, rinses, then wrings them out. In the tiny machine that squeezes the juice out of wet bathing suits, huge bras and undies, shirts, sweaters, tights, multiple hiker socks splurt out their wetness. Pools of water spread across the floor. I slosh through in my flip-flops. The cleaning lady, who speaks a combo of Serbo-Croatian and English, sputters her anger in both languages. The Y, meanwhile, has made a huge poster of the fish lady that hangs with a certain dignity in the foyer. She poses in goggles, flippers, layers and layers of clothes, all dressed up for her 6 hours of doggy paddling back and forth, back and forth, back and forth in her lane like the serious lap swimmers. Next poem is Me and Two Old Friends. And this is based on a sculpture by James A. West. It's called Points of View, and it stands on Grandview Avenue in Mount Washington, just across the street from the Monterey Bay Fish Grotto. Me and two old friends. They sit almost nose to nose, high above the Pittsburgh Point, where the nation's first father saw the gateway to the West. Two old friends. Gaius Suda had guided young George through woods along these once fresh rivers. Washington's sword is secure in scabbard. 2 feet touch ground. The Seneca leader crouches in defense, tomahawk in hand, 1 foot grounded, the other pressed to stone, ready to leap. Their eyes narrow. Neither trusts the other in these woods. They talk about a promise to limit settlers west of the Alleghenies. The white man looks west and tries to soothe his friend with diplomatic lies that anyone could recognize. Me and my boyfriend. This is also my husband. All he did was touch his knee to my hip. My sex danced like the maypole had arrived. Why would a 5-gram med reduction set me sizzling like a red-hot teenager? Forget the why, fool. Forget the leg cramp. Accept the gift with wide-open response.
The poetry of Anne Curran. Thank you so much for being here, Anne.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.